You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We've got an hour of romping across economics and social change on issues large and small. Why is the global recovery working as well as it is? Former IMF economist Ken Rogoff from Harvard takes us into a heated argument between economists. We'll also look at whether big corporations have more, not less, capacity to innovate than smaller startups. We look at a TV show that's changed the world, and we note that one of this country's biggest exports is Kentucky bourbon. It's the largest export category of all U.S. spirits, 28.7 million gallons to 126 different countries back in 2010. Maybe that's why Suntory of Japan is buying Jim Beam for a cool $13.6 billion. We'll talk about it. But we begin with the economic recovery and the heated arguments among economists over why it's working or not working, or whether we are actually headed out of the woods or back into it. Joining us now is a man who has been trying to remain at the center of this debate. Ken Rogoff is professor of economics at Harvard University, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. Ken, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So on what basis do you conclude that the U.S. is doing not only reasonably well post-recession, but substantially better than the historical record would indicate?
Well, if you compare the U.S. recovery to past recessions we've had after World War II, we are not doing well. And by the way, I'd hardly say we're doing well overall. But if you compare it to similar recessions after deep financial crises in the United States or around the world, then by that metric, we're not doing so badly. And we're not doing so badly compared to Europe. I would hardly characterize this as a great recovery. Quite the contrary, it's typical after a deep financial crisis. But it is typical, and we're not doing worse than average for what we were hit with.
Does this vindicate the notion of quantitative easing, stimulus, the acquisition of debt in the economy, something you've been very critical of in the past?
Oh, no. I think it doesn't have a clear statement about policy. I do think a lot of U.S. policies were helpful. Certainly the big monetary stimulus was good. I would have liked to have seen more, actually. The initial fiscal stimulus was good. I would have liked to have seen more infrastructure spending. And we did a little bit to help out the subprime homeowners, the low-income people who were underwater with their mortgages. But there, I would have done a lot more.
And when you say you would have done a lot more, you would have enacted policies that would have increased the aggregate debt of the U.S. Treasury in relationship with the GDP?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think as I advocated all along during the financial crisis and when you're hit with it, there's really very little to do. Debt typically doubles, and we did the right thing to do that. Of course, you know, you want a 10 to 15 year plan to sort of exit from that. But in the short term, that's absolutely the right thing to do, as we've been saying all along.
10 to 15 year plan? Oh, thou dost dream.
Well, yeah, I mean, but, you know, things like Social Security, Medicare, you make little changes a long time in advance to try to steer the ship. But that's all you can do. And in the middle of a crisis like this, the government has to act very aggressively. And of course, it's very tough to know when to exit because, for example, the last couple of years, it seemed like Europe might be the next shoe to drop, that the euro might fall apart. So it's been very, very difficult. It's easy to have 20/20 hindsight of what should we have done. But in the thick of it, you know, I certainly wouldn't give our policies an A+, but it could have been a lot worse. And you can see that when you compare to the rest of the world.
How do you respond to the criticism that you and your colleagues have talked a lot about triggering percentages in the amount of debt that economies have, and that the numbers in this recession and recovery and, you know, guarded recovery, as you said, don't necessarily bear out that once you get to 90% debt in relationship to GDP, that growth gets sort of strangled out of the economy or reduced significantly?
Well, actually, what we actually said, as opposed to what polemicists said, we said, was that in a broad range, as debt gets high, you start to enter a vulnerability region where you're at risk of having your growth slow down. There's no sharp trigger point. There's no bright red line, and we stated that very clearly across our papers. In fact, we also did work which said that recessions last much longer than policymakers think after financial crises, and we urge strongly to have very aggressive monetary and fiscal policy. So by no means were we pushing debt to be reduced in the middle of the crisis. That would be a terrible mistake.
One thing about the polemicists you talk about, a columnist in The New Yorker suggested that you played around with numbers to come up with the 90% percentages. How do you respond to that?
We certainly did use numbers. We look at the historical data on debt, and we find that it's very rare to have debt over 90% and very, very rare over 120% historically. That's simply true. And we suggested in an early paper that we noted that growth tends to be lower in those periods, though we were very careful about not saying it was causal. But there were many papers after that. The International Monetary Fund, the European Central Bank set entire divisions on studying what we did. There had been many, many papers that sort of got lost in the polemic discussion. It was widely looked at, and it was widely debated on both sides. I would say the weight of the evidence is that high debt is associated with slow growth. And I think if you look around the world at Greece, at Ireland, at Portugal, and other countries, it's sort of hard to deny that that's an effect. It's not the only thing going on. It depends on your technology. It depends on the policies your government does. It depends on many things. Growth doesn't just depend on your debt. But let's face it, no country aspires to having a really high debt. That's why countries try to ease out of it over the long run.
Although economics is dull, I guess it's really called the dismal science, it's actually quite exciting and interesting to wade into this spirited debate over your work and others. It seems to me the main issue is whether Keynes was right in his approach, and what would he make of the situation right now? What's your position on that?
Well, actually, Keynes was very eclectic about it. So on the one hand, he pushed for very strong government spending in the middle of the recession. On the other hand, as the UK approached World War II, which, of course, he greatly supported, he felt that it was important for the UK to plan ahead for an exit strategy because he saw that debt was approaching a very high level. And Keynes actually advocated very eclectic policies for dealing with debt, as do Reinhardt and I, that you have to think about having higher inflation. You have to think about things like financial repression, where I'm not talking about the United States right now, but certainly in Europe, where pension funds, banks are forced to hold more government debt than usual to help pay it down. And also just restructuring. That was a big mistake in Europe that they didn't write down debts. Obviously, the high debts in the periphery countries are a problem, and they're not likely to grow their way out of it the way that official policy says. And Keynes would, I think, have been creative in trying to find ways to escape from it. It's not all about cutting budget, government budget deficits. That's not always possible. And I think in the case of Greece and other countries in the periphery of Europe, it's just not going to work. They're going to need to be more creative.
Well, then a little takeaway here. If John Maynard Keynes was alive today, do you think he would be a gadfly as he was in his day, as someone on the fringe, or very much a consensus economist based on the policies of today?
Well, I don't think we have a consensus economist today. Reinhardt and I attempt to be in the middle, and people on the right have attacked us, especially during the 2012 campaign, for saying that the recession lasted a long time because it was a financial crisis and not because of bad policies. People on the left said, well, they didn't do enough. I think there's a very broad spectrum of opinion. I don't think it's easy to know in the middle of a crisis like this exactly what the right policy is. It would have been great to have Keynes alive today. He was a magnificent thinker, and I would have been very interested to hear what his views would have been. But I don't think you can presume that we know. I don't think that, you know, people who claim to channel Keynes in the modern world necessarily know what he would have thought.
Well, we're not channeling Keynes here, but we're very interested in your thoughts. Ken Rogoff, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ken Rogoff is professor of economics at Harvard University, former economist at the International Monetary Fund.
One bourbon, one scotch, and one bill. One bourbon, one scotch, and one bill.
Thank you, John Lee Hooker. One bourbon, one scotch, one beer, one vodka, one martini. We'll talk later in the hour about one of this country's most famous exports getting bought by Japan. Jim Beam goes to Tokyo. But we've been asking you, what does your favorite cocktail say about you?
My favorite cocktail would probably be a whiskey tonic. It says about my personality that I have a complex flavor with a side of a bubbly personality.
I buy $2.75 pitchers at the bar, not cocktails. It tells you I'm cheap.
Thanks to TJ in Portland and one of our, let's just say, thrifty listeners in Michigan. Jay on Facebook goes for something more exotic, the Hemingway Daiquiri, though he adds, I'm an idiot for liking a drink that requires a consistently difficult-to-get ingredient, maraschino liqueur. Jay likes a challenge.
Hi, I'm Aaron from Boston, and just like my drink of choice whiskey, I come with a kick.
My favorite cocktail is a gin martini with fresh blue cheese stuffed olives. What does that say about me? Well, it says I want to be James Bond, but I'm stuck here in Wisconsin.
Can I do something for you, Mr. Bond?
Just a drink. A martini, shaken, not stirred.
Hey, Scott, you could still be a mall security guard up there in Wisconsin. That's Bond-like, and it's a real job. Ron in Miami, what can we get you?
My favorite drink is a dirty martini on the rocks in a 12-ounce glass right by the pool, and it says that I drink too much.
Hey, Ron, get some help out there if you need it. Different message from one of your neighbors in Miami Beach, Mojito. It says, I live in Miami, and I'm not that original. In the mint julep world of Monticello, Georgia, one of you, I never developed a taste for sophisticated drinks. I still enjoy rum-based boat drinks and Jimmy Buffett songs. I guess you like the little parasol, too, right? Keeps me young at heart, says Monticello, Georgia. I like a gin and tonic, says Milford, New Hampshire. I like to think that means I'm simple. My boyfriend told me it makes me an old lady. I have no position on that. Salem, Oregon, also a taste for simplicity. Rum and Coke. My cocktail says I'm not complex. What about Danville, California? When I was 17, I picked a Manhattan as my cocktail of choice because it sounded cool, hoping it would say that I'm classy and sophisticated. Well, of course, you're classy and sophisticated. You listen to this program, but how old are you now? I guess that's what we really want to know. Later on this hour, we'll talk about Jim Beam being bought by the Suntory Distillery in Japan. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Share your favorite cocktail and what it says about you. You can send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Next up, innovation from big corporations. It can happen. Coming up here on The Takeaway, John Lee.
And then I sit there, getting high, mellow.
In the boom and bust post-industrial age, economists yearn to discover the perfect cocktail to ensure continued growth and prosperity. Is innovation and entrepreneurship a matter of luck, or can it be cultivated? Yesterday, we heard about the role of universities trying to teach innovation and entrepreneurship in an environment where young people might be encouraged to just jump on the mindless doctor, lawyer, MBA escalator of advancement. An unquestioning approach to education is exactly the wrong one, educators told us. Unquestioning workers looking for corporate shelter is also dangerous inside the biggest companies. Due to their size and longevity, Fortune 500 companies, the GEs of the world, are not seen as the source of new innovation compared to hotshot startups. But entrepreneur Chunka Moy says the biggest companies are strongly motivated to develop skilled innovators and have the resources to follow through on long-term bets. Moy is managing director of the Devil's Advocate Consulting Group, an author of The New Killer Apps, How Large Companies Can Out-Innovate Startups.
The thing about large companies is if you create an innovation division, you've essentially outsourced innovation to a bunch of people outside of the core of the business. And if you do that, most of those innovations will wither before they find a home. At the same time, you need to allow the people at the core to focus on the business at hand of generating the profits that fuel the organization. So it's creating an environment that allows for experimentation, but doing it in such a way that allows for integration back into the company.
So what's a tangible example? Who does this well or who wants to?
The example that we spend a lot of time on is Google. And there's a lot of things that Google is doing well within their core business and their search business, but they're also doing things in spaces that nobody would have ever expected them to do. So, for example, what business does Google have to be in cars? But they've created an environment that allows for exploration of really hard problems that have large potential value, and they've created a mechanism for driving progress there and then thinking about how to bring that back into the core business.
Now, how is that different from Google is so unbelievably large, they have billions and billions to spend, and somebody says, why don't we come up with a driverless car? Okay, fine, let them go do it. How do you bring the strategy back around to make that really relevant to what Google does best right now? And that is basically, you know, search and become a platform, a digital platform for people being online.
Well, the car is a great digital platform. I mean, I think the short answer is you can imagine a lot of potential business opportunities by dominating that car space, by being in that car space. But I think the fascinating thing is that they're also driven by the fact that it's a very large problem with tangible social and human benefits. So, you know, we have worldwide over 1 million people killed each year in car accidents and 50 million injured. And a lot of that is due to the fact that humans are really bad drivers and the technology doesn't make them very good. And that's the key thing. They're thinking really big about this big problem, but they're starting small in terms of how they attack it.
Why did Google seem to not have such success in its partnership with the Cleveland Clinic on healthcare data?
Healthcare is a very complex problem where the solutions deal with lots of different parts of the system. And that one foray into it wasn't enough to crack those other aspects of it.
So you need to bubble up entrepreneurship and get to the point where maybe a big company can capture assets that are actually working. Just sort of driving in and trying to change a space that's as chaotic as healthcare isn't necessarily going to work.
Well, another company that's doing interesting things is Walgreens. And they've sort of moved out of the fact of just being in the pharmacy business and looking at creating healthcare clinics in their stores. And that drives out of a realization that, you know, their footprint of stores is actually very close to a large percentage of the human population, and they can take advantage of new technologies to create these care centers that can deal with the simple problems in healthcare.
And that's Fortune 500 innovation in your view, when Target goes after sort of clinic customers, when Walgreens goes after clinic customers and tries to build a business inside their own brick-and-mortar stores.
Absolutely. It's corporate innovation is when you think really big about a problem that's adjacent to your space and then find ways to experiment in order to address that problem in a way that's good for the customers and good for yourself. And in that way, extend the logical footprint of your business.
So is the entrepreneurship and innovation of an Apple kind of over with, since there's kind of nothing adjacent to them except other people trying to do exactly what they're doing?
Absolutely not. I think there's many adjacencies to where Apple is. Now, one of the things that they're going to have to deal with is, you know, it's easy to innovate when it's consistent with your business model. It's hard to innovate when it becomes no longer consistent with your business model. So, for example, Kodak, you know, could innovate in photography. But when that technology that they invented, digital photography, was no longer consistent with their existing business model around film, they couldn't figure out a way of taking advantage of it. Now, Apple's situation is you know, there's a lot of growth, a potential in their current space, but the advance of technology is going to suck the profits out of that. So what happens when the next set of products, for example, wearables, are no longer consistent with this high-end business model that Apple has?
Who, in your experience, has taken within a big company the most extraordinary risk that's actually paid off?
I think the best example today is Google. You know, it's yet to pay off in a dramatic way, but the options they're creating around glass, around cars, has the potential of being great businesses on their own, but also synergistic with the current business.
So if you're someone with an entrepreneurial spirit, with a taste for innovation and want to take risks, and you say to yourself, well, I'm not going to go near a Fortune 500 company because that's certainly a way to end up in the mailroom, what would you tell them?
I would say that startups are overrated, for one thing. Research shows that almost 95% of startups fail. There's certainly a room for startups, but the reason startups succeed in general is because there are so many of them, not because they have a better entrepreneurial environment. So if you're a corporate innovator, I would say the grass is not greener on the other side.
If you make it as an entrepreneur, so many people tell the story of it was my failures, it was my mistakes that really led me to the point where I finally did something where I could succeed. Do Fortune 500 companies have the patience to allow people in-house to make enough space or enough mistakes to learn what they need to learn to actually succeed?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things they have to do differently on. But I think the thing we have to remember is that failure, even in the best corporate environment, is different than failure in a startup space. In startups, as you say, you're doing rapid cycles, and failure is part of your resume. You trumpet it because you say you took the risk. In large corporate environments, failure is really more career risky. That's why I think that the way that large companies approach innovation can't be like a startup environment. They can't let 1,000 flowers bloom and hope to harvest some of them. They have to be more selective.
All right. Tchanka Moy, Managing Director of the Devil's Advocate Group, a consulting firm that helps organizations stress test their innovation strategies. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
The priceless art saved, not from a roof leak or smoke damage, but from the bankruptcy court's blunt hammer, I guess you'd call it a gavel. A group of local and national philanthropists put together a deal to save the Detroit Institute of Art collection. Dr. Paul Skop put up his own $5 million alongside his wife. We talked some weeks back with him about this Hail Mary play. Success, doctor. Are you in the end zone on this one?
I wouldn't say we're in the end zone, but if you want to use that sort of picture, we're probably on the 30-yard line.
Well, you're doing better than the Detroit Lions in the playoff season, that's for sure.
That's true.
Tell us about this deal.
Major foundations in particular, and with our pledge, and I believe some others, put together, or Judge Rosen has put together, $330 million toward saving the DID treasures, as well as help supporting the pensioners of the Detroit City.
Now, they are linked because, in some sense, the judge has asked the assets of the city to really, you know, become the cash that's going to compensate the pensioners. So, $330 million gets us part of the way to the full pension obligation. Why does this save the Detroit art collection when it seems like there's a lot more money to be made up if the pensioners are to be made whole?
Well, what's at risk in particular, and the judge has made this clear, as well as the emergency manager, are those parts of the collection, the pieces of art, that were purchased with Detroit City money many, many years ago. And they're focused on that. And that's what Christie valued. And that was somewhere roughly $500 million.
You're talking about
that's where the number comes from.
You're talking about Christie's auction house. They're
yes,
sort of managing
correct.
All of this.
That's right.
So what pieces particularly are at risk and what have been saved, as far as you can tell, from this deal that was put together?
Well, the pieces that are, if you will, most at risk, of course, are the most valuable ones. The wedding dance is certainly one of them. A Van Gogh self-portrait is another, and several of the really invaluable pieces of art.
Now, why would you invest in art that you can't own, that in fact would remain in a museum? Usually, philanthropists give money to put their own art collections into museums.
If it's in the museum, everyone can enjoy it. In fact, our family, some from California, went to the museum on Sunday. And we went through some of the galleries in particular, saw the wedding dance, saw the Van Gogh, along with, of course, many, many others. And that's what a museum is all about, sharing.
Has this controversy and this difficulty, financial difficulty, really raised the profile of the museum for all the people of Detroit, do you think? Brought people into the museum who might not have come?
I think that could be the case. I don't have enough comparisons of times there, but I will tell you, Sunday afternoon, the museum was full of people.
How did that make you feel?
Oh, wonderful. From families, little children, others going through the galleries. The children listen. They have a story hour on Sundays for the children. No, it was fabulous to see all those people there.
When we last spoke, did you believe this was going to happen this quickly?
I'm an optimist. I was hopeful. And it had to happen quickly if it was going to happen at all, because Kevin Orr, the emergency manager, has a job to do in creating his plan of adjustment, and that's to be this month.
You are an optimist today. Were you an optimist when we spoke?
Oh, yes, sure I was. Otherwise, I wouldn't have, with my wife, come forward.
Paul Skop is a Detroit philanthropist who pledged $5 million to save the city's art, part of a structured deal that may save the Detroit Museum of Art collection and help with the pension obligations in the city of Detroit that are central to the bankruptcy. Paul, thanks so much.
You're quite welcome, John.
With the Winter Olympics nearly upon us, which will depict healthy, bright-eyed skaters and skiers in Sochi, Russia for two competitive weeks, Russia will also get a closer look, and it's not a picture of health. In fact, the ideological conflict in Russia over homosexuality may be part of a more general climate of moral conservatism and intolerance that may be responsible for some of the worst rates of HIV infection in the world. Worldwide, annual HIV infections dropped by almost a third in 2012 from 2011. They are rising by 13% annually, though, in Russia, where AIDS is the third leading cause of death, led by the enormous population of young IV drug users. 21% of the world's HIV-positive drug users live in Russia. Simeon Bennett covers healthcare at Bloomberg News in Geneva. Simeon, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So based on your understanding of the GDP of Russia, its ability to deliver services to its citizens, how shocking would you say in context these healthcare figures are that you write about?
Yeah, well, John, certainly the problem in Russia is not a problem of money. I mean, we've seen with other HIV epidemics around the world, notably in sub-Saharan Africa, that most of the significant part of the problem there during the 1980s and the 1990s was a problem of funding, that there just wasn't the money to buy the antiretrovirals, do the testing, and provide all of those services to the people who needed it. That's just not the case in Russia. As you point out, Russia is a wealthy country, and they like telling everybody that they're a wealthy country. So the problem is ideological or political rather than financial. And really what it comes down to is that the services that would help to arrest the epidemic are not being provided for political and ideological reasons. And really, as part of, I guess, of Putin's appealing to or consolidating his conservative electoral base.
The notion that methadone doesn't work in Russia, is that something you actually heard spoken by presumably responsible officials?
Yeah, it is. The actual statement that I got from the gentleman in the health ministry, a guy by the name of Alexei Mazas, his title is that he's the head specialist of HIV treatment. His written statement to me was that the evidence of the success of methadone programs, or what we call opioid substitution therapy, in other countries is not evidence of their success. And that here in Russia, we have our own way of doing things. We have our own proven means of preventing HIV, which you would say is all well and good, except for the fact that it's clearly not working and the epidemic is raging on.
Did the health ministry official respond to the fact that new infections jumped 13% in 2012, and that's completely at odds with almost anywhere else in the world?
Well, the answer that you will get to that question is that methadone is not the answer, that the problem lies with drugs. And if we want to address the HIV problem, then we need to address the drug problem. So the policy approach is very much cracking down on drugs, taking a very hard line to drugs. And again, that is a policy that has been tried elsewhere and has failed elsewhere, unfortunately. So for the time being, you know, the epidemic will go on. And I guess eventually it will get to a point where someone says, look, you know, what we're doing is not working. We need to try something else, but we're not at that point yet.
And the takeaway is that ideology and sort of moral, I guess you would call it narrowness, really trumps health policy.
On this particular issue, yes. And even Vadim Pokrovsky, the director of the Federal AIDS Center, when I spoke to him, really cut a very frustrated figure. He knows this stuff works. He knows that they need to be doing this. But basically, he doesn't have the power to do it. Someone else above him is preventing him or denying him the tools that he knows he needs to try and prevent infections. And how long that will continue for is anybody's guess.
Simeon Bennett covers healthcare at Bloomberg News in Geneva. He reported on Russia's HIV epidemic for the February issue of Bloomberg Markets magazine. Simeon, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
For this next story, we start in Kentucky.
I remember, dear, not long ago, you said you'd be my own.
There's nothing more American than this stuff.
What is it?
Jim Beam. It's okay. Just drink it.
Kentucky gave us Bill Monroe and bluegrass, the Derby, and one more thing.
No, Mother, I have not been drinking. No. No, these two men, they poured a whole bottle of bourbon into me. No, they didn't give me a chaser.
Cary Grant acting drunk on American Kentucky bourbon. Brown, corn-fermented, oak-barreled, all-American whiskey.
Maybe I should have saved those leftover dreams.
Frank Sinatra preferred it, as did this U.S. president.
There can be no peace in the world until the power of Japan is destroyed.
Harry Truman loved his bourbon, which makes all this a tiny bit ironic.
Now you go and let me hear a traveler's moan.
One of the legends of Kentucky bourbon, Jim Beam, is turning Japanese.
For relaxing times, make it Suntory time.
The Japanese distillery Suntory is buying Jim Beam for more than $13 billion. Will this acquisition mash up, culturally speaking?
I never thought you'd go away, leave me all alone.
Sour mash is kind of the idea with bourbon, right? We turn now to Charles Cowdery. He's the author of Bourbon, Straight, the Uncut and Unfiltered Story of American Whiskey. Welcome, Charles.
Good to be here.
Well, let's talk first of all about the so-called global boom in whiskey spirits. That's been around for a while. It's really taken off over the last decade or so.
Well, it's been a couple of phases. It really started to pick up steam in the... at least a little bit in the very late 80s, early 90s internationally. Then in the United States really started to pick up right around year 2000. And then in the last 3 years or so, it's gone into another gear altogether. And this has really been, I think, the thing that has surprised people is that it's gone into a sort of a stratosphere that nobody would have predicted.
And there's nothing more – I've said this. There's nothing more American than bourbon. I mean, it really started out with the Whiskey Rebellion at the very beginning of American history, pushed distillers west where they couldn't be taxed so easily. They ended up in Kentucky. Pick up the story from there.
Well, that's a bit of a myth, although it's certainly a good outline for what happened as far as the pushing people west. But – yeah, the thing that when you crossed the Appalachians, you came to an area where corn grew much better than rye. And of course, corn was still kind of unfamiliar to the colonists, it being a New World grain. That was really the thing that happened in Kentucky, was the use of corn as the primary grain. And corn gives you a much sweeter whiskey than rye, which is what they had primarily been using up until that point. That was really what kind of got bourbon started. When they started shipping that sweet corn whiskey outside of Kentucky to point south, people said, boy, you know, they like that. And especially in the French-speaking areas, when you get down into St. Louis and down into New Orleans, they thought it tasted more like cognac.
So it took off immediately in the U.S. What was it, though, that made American bourbon whiskey, sweet whiskey, compete with Scotch, which was a much more established brand in the 20th century than American bourbon?
Well, yeah, let's jump ahead to Prohibition and the post-Prohibition period. and you had because you have an aged product, it you can't just turn on the spigot. So when Prohibition ended, there was very little American whiskey available that was at least that was fully aged, and so you had people drinking whiskey from Canada, drinking whiskey from Scotland, and actually Americans had been drinking rye whiskey more before Prohibition too. It was really after Prohibition that bourbon sort of came into its own, and it really was a long time before it really spread outside the United States. The exports really only got going, as I said, in that sort of late 80s period when, ironically enough, it was Japan and Japanese consumers who decided that they liked bourbon, and they had been and still are very much a Scotch-drinking country. But the younger generation wanted something different, and they turned to bourbon. That was really what kind of launched the current renaissance.
You know, the Asian connection is pretty interesting. Last year, when the president signed a free trade agreement with Korea, one of the top items on the list was to remove a Korean tariff on American bourbon. That's how strong the demand is for bourbon in Korea and how much money the government was making off of it from an excise tax. So what do you think it does to the Jim Beam brand to be acquired by Suntory?
Bourbon has to be made in the United States. So and most of it, of course, is made in Kentucky. So it's not going to change where it's manufactured. It's not going to change how it's manufactured. All those things are controlled by U.S. law. So it's really all to the good in the sense of if more of it can be sold in these other countries, that's what's going to keep the industry robust. And it's always going to be an American industry, regardless of who technically owns this or that company.
Your favorite cocktail, Charles?
Well, I mean, my favorite cocktail is just bourbon in a glass, but probably my second favorite cocktail would be Manhattan, and I like Manhattans because you can make them a million different ways. You never have to make them the same way twice.
Charles Cowdery is author of Bourbon Straight, the Uncut and Unfiltered American Whiskey. Thanks so much, Charles.
Thank you.
So Charles' gravelly voice retains a hint of whiskey in it, I think it's safe to say, kind of like the breath of Shane McGowan of the Pogues. Don't sit in the front row at their concerts. Hey, Bonnie, pick your poison.
I like my vodka straight up and strong, because that's the kind of girl I am.
My drink is 12-year-old single malt scotch poured straight into a glass. I guess that says I'm old-fashioned.
Old-fashioned Randy from St. Helens, Oregon, goes for a classic American. I drink a good quality bourbon, straight on the rocks, no nonsense, strong, direct, and simple with plenty of substance. Morristown, New Jersey, my favorite cocktail, a real martini with good gin and dry vermouth. Says I'm loyal. What does your favorite drink say about you? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Much more at thetakeaway.org. Heard about the power of television? The case that shared events on TV have had an enormous impact on society at large, for good or ill. Anti-smoking campaigns, celebrity careers made in a single TV moment, news footage of famine generating an outpouring of millions in aid, dramatic TV images causing people to make a decision they might not have made but for the small screen. Well, how about low-key entertainment like this? Basic cable reality TV, changing the world?
Keeping the baby will be really expensive, especially if my mom kicks me out of the house. So, even though I'm almost 9 months pregnant, I walk a mile to my job just to earn a minimum wage paycheck. But I'm not sure if that will be enough to support a baby. So I need to talk to Matt about all this. But he's been really flaky lately.
That's from the MTV series 16 and Pregnant. Each week, a tough, upbeat teen mom deals with an event that can't help but to transform her life and the lives of those around her, the birth of a baby.
You know, you're still in high school and you're talking a baby, a new house. Do you know how much responsibility that is? Well, how are you going to work? Is Colin going to be able to afford that alone?
Yeah, for right now. He's talking about rejoining the army, which is really good money.
Yeah, it's really good money, but he's going to be gone.
No, he's not.
They can get called up at any time.
As many as 3 million viewers tune in to that show and its spinoff, Teen Mom, 16 and Pregnant. Does this show encourage a kind of teen mom bonding for sexually active kids? Does it give permission for more babies born to teens? Or is it a series of cautionary tales encouraging more thoughtful behavior on the part of young girls? The producers of 16 and Pregnant may not need to be terribly interested in that question, but economist Melissa Kearney decided to try and answer the question. She co-authored a study looking at viewing records, Nielsen ratings, and birth rates, and discovered that the show and its spinoff may have prevented more than 20,000 births to teenage mothers in 2010. Kearney is a professor at the University of Maryland, director of the Hamilton Project at the Brookings Institution. She joins us now from Washington, D.C. Melissa, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
How can you be sure this TV show prevented 20,000 births and didn't encourage 120,000 more?
That's the key question. So it could have gone either way, as you posed the question. We didn't know the way this particular media portrayal of teen pregnancy was going to resonate with teens. But what my co-author Phil Levine and I did was use pretty sophisticated statistical analyses that economists use to really get to the bottom of causal relationships in data. So we worked very hard to relate viewership of this show to subsequent trends in teen childbearing. And the way we've done this is to look across markets in the USA and look in the places where more teens were watching this show. How did subsequent trends in teen childbearing relate to that viewership? And what we find is that in places where more teens are watching MTV, we see larger decreases in rates of teen childbearing. So this was pretty compelling evidence. And we match it up with Google search and Twitter data as well to try and figure out what were teens thinking when they watched the show. And that confirmed for us what we were seeing in terms of the birth data. And so what we found in the Google and Twitter data was that when this show aired, and then in the next day, we see large spikes in searches on Google for how to get birth control. And on Twitter data, we see large spikes, again, co-timed with when the show is on the air, in people tweeting things about 16 and pregnant and birth control. And in fact, those increase in searches and tweets correspond to the places where more young adults are watching MTV.
Absolutely fascinating. We're talking with Melissa Kearney, who's a professor of economics at the University of Maryland. Let's bring into the conversation Devin Broyles, whose voice you heard there in the introduction, talking to her mom, one of the stars of MTV's 16 and Pregnant. Devin, welcome.
Welcome. How are y'all doing?
Great. How old are you right now?
I'm 19.
And how old is your baby?
He's 2.
And what were the circumstances of you getting involved with this show? I mean, you got paid, right?
Yeah, we get paid, and a lot of people... I see a lot of people tweeting and saying things about, oh, well, they get pregnant just to be on the show and just to get paid. Well, my circumstance wasn't like that. Those weren't my intentions. But we only get paid $2,500 for a show. So it's not as much as people think.
All right. Well, no, that's great to hear you say that. Now, how do you feel about the possibility that people look at your story and the story of young women like yours on the show and decide, I never want to end up like that? Are you clear? Is your message, don't do what I did, or is it more complicated than that?
I wanted people to, like, see the reality of it, to, like, get the message out there. Like, it's not easy. Like, I see young girls, and they're talking about getting pregnant, and it's just, it's not what people, like, portray it, I guess, and that's what the show kind of, like, shows.
So would you advise a 16-year-old to do what you've done or not?
No, I would, like, if I could prevent one pregnancy, that would be amazing, because it is not easy being a teen parent.
You've done more than one. Let me just ask you a couple of personal questions. Is your baby's dad still in the picture?
Yes.
All right, so you're lucky in that sense.
Yes.
Compared to a lot of the stories. And yeah. How are you financially?
Good. I mean, we have split custody, but we're not together. He gets him 1 week and I get him another week. And that's how we decided to do it, which we thought was best for Landon, because he loves his dad and he loves me.
And your mom, is she full of I told you so's?
Yeah. Yes.
Really? Oh, God. Sorry, Mom, if you're listening. Melissa Kearney, is this social science that's taking place as a result of this entertainment show encountering kids watching TV?
Well, we know from the Nielsen ratings data that this show is wildly popular. Lots of people are watching this. And so, Devin, I applaud you. You're very brave and gracious to share your story. And it does certainly seem to have resonated with teenagers who might have become teen parents. If it were the case that only people who would never become teen moms watch this show, it wouldn't have had such an impact. Or if the stories and the characters in the show didn't relate to people watching it, it wouldn't have had such an impact.
Any way to estimate what impact on the national teen birth rate is from this show?
Yes. So that's what we've worked very hard to do. And the data suggests that this show has led to a 5.7% reduction in teen births in the 18 months after it first aired in June 2009. So that is a very large effect, but I also want to emphasize that it's a plausible effect. So we know over this period since the show aired, starting in 2009, there was a steep rate of decline off of just an ongoing trend. And we attribute a half of that steepness to the Great Recession. Births respond to economic conditions, and that's true of non-teen births and teen births. When it's harder to get a job to support your family, fewer people have babies. But, and then this is a third. This show accounts for a third of the decline.
Devin, did those numbers surprise you?
Yes, because I see just so many people talking about how we're stupid for being on the show. The show is stupid. It's never going to prevent anybody from getting pregnant. So, yeah, it's awesome.
Well, it makes you feel good, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Well, Devin, have a great day today.
All right. Thank you. You too.
Devin Broyles, mother of a two-year-old. What's your two-year-old's name?
Landon.
Landon, mother of Landon, one of the young women featured on MTV's 16 and Pregnant. And Melissa Kearney is a professor of economics at the University of Maryland, director of the Hamilton Project, a research group at the Brookings Institution. Melissa, thanks.
Thanks so much.
Catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the show, especially that conversation. Check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.